Hello, everybody, and welcome to the On the Farm Pitcher List podcast about all things prospect, dynasty, and minor league related. We all obviously want y'all to keep track of what's happening over at Pitcher List. You got to subscribe to the Pitcher List Podcast Network. You can find this podcast there, of course, as well as all of the other podcasts that Pitcher List has to offer. We are constantly adding new podcasts. We're going to have a bunch of really great guests. Nick and Eno just started a podcast recently together. There's just so many good shows that are happening over there. So make sure to check out the full podcast network if you haven't already. Leave us a rating and a review if you do so choose. We are your humble guests today. We are myself, Jake, Mesh, and of course, the one, the only, the deep league guru, Richard the Hawk. Hake, how you doing today, Rick?
Jeez, what an introduction, man.
Oh, you want an introduction? I gave you an introduction. You know, I'm a man of the people.
That was an 80 grade introduction right there.
No, I'm working on it. Workshop it. If you got any comments, leave them.
Exactly. I'm doing all right, man. Enjoying opening day, watching currently as we're recording, watching the Cubs and Rangers game. So that's always fun time. And that's decided they wanted to take the day off. A little bit of rain.
Yeah. Well, unlike you, I am locked into the podcast. I don't have my TV on. No, I'm kidding. Of course, you know, it was really just with my random work schedule. Yesterday, I had the full day off because Good Friday is a holiday, but we work on Good Friday, so we get a different day off during the week. And of course, I was randomly assigned Wednesday, day before opening day. And then today I had back-to-back meetings, like wall-to-wall. So I wasn't aware, privy of anything happening. So I had to catch up a bunch when I got home. And then all the games ended. And they all ended at like 7. And I was like, I just sat down. It was horrible scheduling, in my opinion.
We were really holding out for this game. We were watching that long extra innings game with Miami and Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And that one just kept going on and on and on. And that was fantastic. And then watched Houston and the Yankees. That was a good one for a while. And then watched the Dodgers and St. Louis. So that was a pretty good game, watching Victor Scott play a little bit.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We'll talk about Victor a little bit. We'll talk about a nice handful of guys who broke camp with the Major League roster, the prospects that we've been talking about all offseason. That's what we're going to start with today. We're going to look just at guys who had no previous Major League experience, made their debuts, not necessarily made their debuts, maybe are set up to make their debuts. Guys haven't appeared yet. Games haven't happened yet, but guys who broke camp after not having played in the big leagues before. And then after that, we'll break down a few of those guys. Then we're going to talk about some draft-eligible 2024 MLB draft-eligible college players who are, some are standing out this season, really improving their draft stock, and others who have struggled to get going, but we still believe in their talent, so wanted to kind of like bring up maybe where we could see some guys falling in the draft coming up, where some values that you might be able to get and whatnot there. But to start, like I said, prospects who made the team. And so there's a list of guys. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. There's 10 guys that made the major league roster out of camp who had never appeared in a major league baseball game before. A lot of top names. You know, you got Wyatt Langford, you got Jackson Churio, Jackson Merrill, then you got like Victor Scott, big hype name, was able to sneak in there with the injury to Dylan Carlson. Then you got a couple pitchers that are in the bullpen. You got Jordan Leisure, Clayton Beter, Cade Smith, Mitch Spence. And then you got a couple bench hitters like Daryl Hernandez and Graham Pauly, who in my opinion should not be a bench hitter. Boo, Padres. So you got these guys who have, you know, come into the league, who have really performed well in spring training. And now we're kind of, a few of them, you know what you're going to get out of them. You know that Langford's going to play every day. You know that, you know, Chichurio's going to play every day. Just got that huge extension. But a lot of these guys are kind of still even fighting for roles, even after opening day. So we're going to talk about a couple of them that we've had our eyes on. Rick, did you have one that really stands out to you that you wanted to start with?
Yeah, you know, we were talking a little bit before this. Obviously, with Jordan Leisure, he is a prospect that is being talked about a lot, you know, over the offseason, and rightfully so. The numbers were pretty impressive in terms of what he was able to do last year at AAA. We learned a little bit more about this before the podcast as well, that he came over originally from the Dodgers, drafted by the Dodgers, traded in the Lance Lynn and Joe Kelly trade. So that was pretty interesting to be able to find out a little bit about him. He did pitch in the Arizona Fall League, which I saw him in person. He was really, really effective. Definitely a lot of upside here. For him making the major league club, I thought that that was really interesting, that they didn't want him to start the year in AAA. But from what I've been seeing with even a lot of these deeper dynasty leagues, 30-team dynasty leagues, people are paying up right away. And rightfully so, the White Sox bullpen is looking pretty spotty. And I know a lot of folks are already saying that, you know, he could end up working into some high leverage situations relatively quickly. So with Jordan Leisure, he's definitely one I want to be able to keep an eye on. He didn't get into the game today, but hopefully we'll end up seeing him soon. Jacobs, what was some of the things that you saw when it came to Jordan Leisure?
Yeah, I think he's definitely an exciting arm. He's gotten a ton of hype. I think we'll see kind of how that hype kind of stacks up to the results early on. You know, the White Sox have a pretty wide open situation in the bullpen. That being said, they do have some veterans there that will definitely get the first opportunities at, you know, the closing gig. Definitely don't expect him to be really sniffing those opportunities anytime soon. But the season is very long. A lot of things can happen. We don't know what the White Sox long-term plan is with, like, Kopech, for example. Maybe he starts to work some longer appearances down the line in the season if there are some more injuries to, like, the starting rotation or something. John Brebbia is, you know, a veteran, hasn't closed a ton of games, but also had a bit of an injury scare in the spring. He's definitely an option. Steven Wilson, another veteran, and definitely coming over from San Diego. He's got some experience in late innings, but not necessarily closing either. You know, those guys are all, you know, definitely going to get shots. But I think Leisure has an opportunity to just kind of, you know, do his thing in like the sixth inning and really kind of give us a better idea or a better sense of watching him. You know, I think in redraft leagues, you know, watching him, but I'm not anticipating really rostering him much this year in saves leagues. But if he's really available in just about any dynasty league, I think he's a great dynasty buy because, you know, it might be too late. It's a lot of guys have been added him already. But if you're not needing him to contribute saves, I think he probably takes that role at some point, maybe going into next year. Don't think that the White Sox are going to go out and get a closer on the market anytime soon. You know, I think there's a chance that Kopech runs away with it, but I'm not ready to commit to him being in the bullpen even next year. So if you're looking for like a nice young fireballer, really in a similar situation to, you know, like maybe Andrés Muñoz that we saw, you know, a couple years ago, and now he's now finally kind of taken to that role. I think it might be kind of a similar timeline, right? You got to wait while he's kind of the setup guy and paying his dues a little bit before he might get that opportunity. That being said, he's not quite the nastiness of Andrés Muñoz. He's obviously a special talent. But Leisure's good. You know, he really relies on a fastball slider primarily. Fastball sits 97, 98. Slider sits high 80s, like 88, 89. It's interesting because his release point is not super high, not an outlier. But his arm slot is pretty high up there. He gets really low in his legs and really drives. And you could kind of see in his delivery how he creates the ride on his fastball. I mean, he really looks like he's kind of like driving through, and it's almost kind of the right, it's like for hitters, the uppercut swing. And he does get really good ride. It plays really all everywhere in the zone. And I mean, his stuff's been really good. Looking at some of his data from AAA, courtesy of Chris Clegg in the Dynasty Dugout. Let's see here. In AAA last year, he had 230 pitches. I'm not quite sure how many innings it was. It was like 20 innings, maybe. Let's see here. 38.7% ball percentage. That's about average, you know, for a young reliever with good stuff. Nothing too concerning there. 15% swinging strike rate, love that. 32% CSW, that's solid. And then, of course, the 25% K minus walk percentage. So the results were good. Results were good. Stuff looks good. You know, it. You don't have to imagine too much to see him in a really, you know, primary late inning role, really by the end of the year. So I think he's, I mean, I think if Kopech or Brebbia takes the job, I could see him as like the first or second setup guy. That then again, it's the White Sox, so there's not a ton of opportunities to close out games and, you know, to get the holds. So, you know, it's, you're really more betting on, I think, the talent at this point winning out than maybe the White Sox getting a little bit better next year. But, you know, even Trevor May got his like 20 saves last year on the A's, so you never know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it'll be very interesting to see what he's able to do and carve out this upcoming year. Another one, Jake, that I was really kind of interested in, brought it up here before the pod, we were kind of going back and forth with it, was Cade Smith with the Cleveland Guardians. He made the Major League opening day roster, which is awesome. He didn't get into the game. He stands 6'5", 230 pounds. He's 24 years old. But he's got some really interesting stuff. And whenever you look at the numbers throughout his minor league career, he has gotten several, multiple save opportunities. Last year, in general, he had 15 saves between AA and AAA, in which I'm looking here with his strikeout rates. He's never had a strikeout rate below 11.86. And he finished AAA last year with a 14.61. When you look at what he was able to do in spring training this year, he appeared in 9 games, 9 innings pitched, 12 K per 9, finished with a 2 ERA with a 1.41 FIP. And whenever you look at his average against, yeah, he was about a 2.57 or a 0.257 average against. So that could be down a little bit more. But what's interesting, Jake, is that he didn't walk anybody this spring. This is something that he has kind of dealt with throughout the minor leagues in terms of walks. But this is a guy that I think could, you know, potentially get into some, you know, really interesting roles with the Guardians this year. And with Stefan being out for, I believe, the season, you know, this might be one of their, you know, backup plans here for Barlow as well as Clace going into the season. So he's very interesting to me from that standpoint, making the opening day roster. The other one that I wanted to bring up here real quick with the Yankees would be Clayton Beter. Another Dodgers draftee that was traded to the Yankees. Really solid stuff. Great K per nines throughout his minor league career. AAA at 11.28 K per nine. You know, pitched very solid throughout spring training. Ended up finishing with a 3.18 ERA in 5 appearances, 2 starts. So I think he'll primarily maybe work out of the bullpen for the beginning. He might end up getting a turn through the rotation or so before heading back down. But I really like the stuff that he has. He has a really solid fastball, slider, curveball combination. I don't know. I think that there's a lot to like here if they're able to give him an opportunity.
Yeah, no, I could definitely see that. I think Beter, Beter was an interesting guy last year. He made it up to AAA and did pretty well. He, if I remember correctly, he followed Will Warren. Will Warren got the call to AAA first, and then Beter followed a little bit later. But, you know, he performed better. The thing that kind of tripped him up in AAA last year was the walks. And he didn't throw a lot of strikes. Like, it was his 13.8% walk rate was backed up by a pretty tough ball percentage. It was about 41-42%. And so, you know, that could, I mean, AAA is a completely different animal than AA, of course. Some guys just have trouble adjusting to the better hitters, you know, with better plate discipline. And so, and the Yankees felt good enough about him to add him to the 40 man. He was added over the offseason, and now he makes the opening day roster. You know, he's in the bullpen right now, but, you know, I think there's definitely going to be opportunities in the season. And if they need a spot start, he probably, I think he gets the call before anyone in, you know, that might be in AAA. I don't think they're really going to have him do like one inning stints. They'll probably try to keep him stretched out a little bit, maybe do some like longer relief roles. But yeah, I think that he is like a solid option. He does a lot of work. Again, another kind of primarily fastball slider guy. Decent velo, averages right around 94. The slider has a really good move, to really good spin on the slider. So yeah, I think there's a good profile there to kind of build off of, and definitely look for him to get a spot start and try to hop on that in your leagues. And then with Cade Smith, the other guy that you mentioned, he's really fascinating to me. You know, Cade Smith was able to really improve his strike throwing ability after he's promoted to AAA last year, which is not super common. Usually it goes the other way. You know, we've seen that in prospects all the time. Pretty much every time a prospect gets promoted from AA to AAA, they start throwing less strikes, and the ball, you know, the ball percentage goes up, the walk rate goes up. Cade Smith turned into a strike throwing machine. He was a in AA, he was a 40% ball percentage guy, and then in AAA, he was a 35.5% ball percentage guy, and that's in double the amount of pitches in AAA. And so it's a good sample. It's a bigger sample than the AA sample. And he still, what was interesting was he had an 11.6% walk rate in AAA. Does not reflect the amount of strikes that he threw. And he threw more, or he allowed more walks. He had a higher walk rate than Jordan Leisure did in AAA. But Jordan Leisure had a 39% ball percentage, and Cade Smith has a 35.5. So I think that's interesting. I think that, I wouldn't be surprised at all if he's maybe a 9% walk rate reliever as he gets going in the major leagues over a bigger sample. And with the fact that he didn't walk anyone in spring training, love that. And it's nice because you got Leisure on one end, who doesn't have like horrible command, but definitely more of a stuff guy. And then you have Cade Smith, who is, you know, looks like great command for somebody with as good of a stuff as he has. You know, he's not going to blow you away with the fastball. You know, his fastball average is about 95. He's not really going to like have like the wipeout slider. He has a bit of a deeper arsenal, a couple more pitches he can go to. He's got like the changeup, the curve, they mix this in a little bit as well. But that command, I think, you know, looking at the results that he's been able to have, you mentioned all those strikeouts, you know, at a 13.5% swinging strike, 36.8% CSW, again, just pounding zone. I think it's a good mix of skills that can allow him to, you know, have good success in the back of a bullpen. You know, a lot of guys like Clay Holmes, for example, you know, have success in the back end without necessarily getting a ton of strikeouts, and, you know, really go kind of relying more on the command aspect. And so I really like Cade Smith for a nice well-rounded profile, and then Leisure if you're really looking for those Ks and just coming in and dominate the late innings.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a good call. And with a lot of these deeper dynasty leagues, you know, a lot of these guys were on the waiver wire with the majority of my leagues that I was looking at here in 30 team. So, you know, there's a good chance if you have some prospect, you know, holding areas, if your leagues aren't, you know, if they're in the majors, they need to be on your major league roster. It's not a bad call to be able to pick some of these guys up and just kind of ride it out and see. You know, the worst case scenario, you'll drop them and, you know, you lose nothing. So I definitely like this. Another prospect hitter, we'll go to a hitter for this one. Darryl Hernández is one to really watch with Oakland. You know, just a player that can play all over the infield, and was very successful, only 22 years old. I think he originally came over in the, I think he was drafted originally, yeah, by Baltimore. So he came over in a trade from Baltimore, but did very well the last couple of years. And last year he ended up playing in AA and AAA, in which that combined he slashed 321, 386, 456 with 9 home runs, 13 stolen bases. but a good bat to ball hitter. And I think that with Oakland, I mean, this is what they're going to need in order to, you know, be, you know, successful going forward. So Daryl Hernandez is a guy that I definitely think that we should kind of keep our eye on, you know, in some of the deeper dynasty leagues and see how he can, you know, play up. Last year was a little light in terms of stolen bases. He usually has a little bit more speed than that, but definitely one to watch. One prospect I talked about a little bit with the recent article I put out here on Pitcher List was talking about prospects that, you know, go through their minor league career, their high school career at one position, and then have to make a switch whenever they get to the major league level. And with Jackson Merrill, he was included in that article, you know, moving from a shortstop to an outfielder, you know, and how he's been able to kind of adjust to it so far. With his profile, I like it because, you know, he has the speed to be able to move around out there defensively, and he looks pretty decent out there so far. Definitely a major bat to ball guy. OBP is solid, though the walk rates are not crazy. You know, I don't know how much power he's going to be able to get to long term. It'll be really interesting to see what he's able to do, especially with that massive outfield in San Diego. And for me, he doesn't steal enough to really warrant being a major target in a lot of dynasty leagues, especially like 10-team dynasty leagues. You know, if you need somebody to be able to help your average in OBP, if he's able to continue to do what he did in the minor leagues to this point, that'll be solid. But I just want to try to taper a little bit of expectations here, because if you're looking for anything in terms of power, you know, power and stolen bases, I don't think you're going to get as much as what you might think, right? So right. Jackson Merrill,
no, that makes a lot
I'm
of
just
sense.
Pumping the brakes a little bit.
Yeah, I think for him, what's interesting is that I think the deeper the league you have, the more valuable Jackson Merrill is, because he's somebody who should play every day in center field and hold his own. I don't think he's really going to give the Padres much reason to like move him to the bench, you know, because he has good, like you said, good bat ball skills. He's going to have good batting average. And for somebody who plays every day, even at the bottom of the lineup, has a good sample size, you know, good number of plate appearances with good batting average, you know, and gets just like just enough runs and RBIs just being in that lineup, a good Padres lineup. He's even if he's at it in the bottom of the order, less at bats, but he does have that Padres top of the order behind him. You know, I think that he's just going to be able to accumulate stats and at like a modest level, even kind of out of the gate. So that is not sexy. That is not exciting in a 10 teamer and a 12 teamer. It shouldn't probably be on a starting roster spot for you. But if you're looking at a 15-teamer, I think it's okay. You know, I think it's like just above replacement level and should be solid for you with a little bit of upside. If you're on a 30-team dynasty league, run that guy out there and love everything you get from him, you know, because just everyday players are awesome, especially like an up-the-middle everyday player. The team loves these guys. So, you know, I think the deeper you get with him, the more you should hang on to him tightly for sure. All right, and then moving down the list here, I wanted to bring up the Victor Scott versus Esturi Ruiz debate. I think it's fun. I think it really just speaks to our tendency to compare, like just to bucket everything. Like I just, as humans, I have a degree in anthropology, y'all. This is my way to flex it here. We are very like categorical. Everything needs to be compartmentalized. Everything needs to be categorized. And we see speedy man and we go, yeah, like this is who you are compared against. This is the profile for you. It is, you know, Victor Scott, it is D Gordon, it is Esturi Ruiz, you know, it's John Birdie. Like this is the group, and this is how you it's the context of everything they have been and will continue to be. Thank you, Kamala. I just think it's really fascinating. But to buy into the comparison here, I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, the difference. So Esturi, like, killed him. As far as, if you're comparing, like, results in the minor leagues, Esturi is, like, leagues ahead of this guy. He was having, like, double-digit home run to fly ball rates. Esturi was stealing all these bases. Like, he had a great, you know, great batting average. Put up, like, a 170 WRC plus in AA. So it was, like, a little ridiculous, right? And then we kind of heard all the kind of whisperings like, hey, he kind of sucks. sucks. He's not a great, you know, doesn't get quality of contact, you know. He came out to the major league. Sure enough, not great quality of contact. Now it's very polarizing. But what was interesting about the, you know, experience in Double A? Well, first off, I think, so Victor Scott is a year younger, was a year younger last year than Asturi was when Asturi broke out. Asturi was 23, broke out in Double A, and then continued in Triple A. Victor Scott last year in Double A was 22, and still played really well. I think he had like a 117, 119 WRC plus, and like was solid. Year younger, not a huge difference, but something to note. I think where it really kind of comes into play, as far as the results and the power specifically, is that Asturi was playing in very offensive leagues, very offensive environments, heavy. So and when he was with the Padres, his home park was in San Antonio. Good hitter's park, a lot of offense there. The league in general, very offensive. And then he went to AAA. Where did he play? The PCL. And so I think that there's, you know, when looking back at just like trying to compare Victor Scott, what we can maybe expect from him to Ruiz, I think it's really hard to compare them beyond just the fact that they are fast. You know, even Victor Scott, he hits the ball in the air a lot more. Asturi in those breakout seasons were running about 33% fly ball rates. Victor Scott was in the 40s, like mid to low 40% last year. So, you know, hits the ball in the air more, pulls it a decent amount. And it's possible that he gets to like a bit of power, but you don't need power, especially, you know, depends on the league you're playing. And of course, you know, the depth of the league and the scoring settings. Roto League obviously is more, these guys are more enticing. But, you know, I think that I could be more confident in Victor Scott because he's still a bit younger and he's playing for a much better team on a much better offense. Even if the playing time isn't guaranteed longer than a few weeks as these guys are injured that he's kind of replacing, I think it's possible that the dynamic play that he brings in center field and on the base pass could keep him up there even after these guys come back. And he's just playing in a better lineup, better offensive park. Like, just the situation is so much better for him versus like what we saw from Asturi last year. And Asturi's getting platooned. He didn't play today, or he's not in the lineup today, not opening day. Victor Scott's in the, you know, like, I think that it's hard to compare them directly in a lot of ways, except for, you know, the fact that they're 60 stolen base guys and, you know, similar contact skills, similar power outputs. And so I think that Victor Scott's very legit. And, you know, again, especially in Roto League, especially in a bit deeper leagues, I'm definitely willing to run with him. I have him in a couple of redraft leagues that are like 15 teamers. So I just wanted to add to the comparison dialogue, the discourse there. But mm-hmm. I do think it's really fascinating that we always kind of compare these guys, and it's a fun exercise for sure. Cause you're finding the edge, right? The discrepancies where you can kind of get that extra info. But yeah, two electric guys. And I think Scott just has a bit more ability to impact out of the gate.
I completely agree. Twitter or X was blowing up with these comparisons. And I saw some people saying future Ricky Henderson, like, let's taper this a little bit in terms of putting Hall of Fame comps on prospects.
Speaking of that, oh my God, the ESPN broadcast for Wyatt Langford today, before this man saw two major league pitches, they compared him to Buster Posey, to Mike Trout, to Alex Bregman. Are they on crack? Oh my God. Like, it's fun. It's ESPN. Oh my God, that was so, I was livid.
Just please stop. I know Bochy ended up saying that he is a big baseball mind, and he said that he compared him directly to Buster Posey. And I was like, come on, man, let's not do this. Like, listen, he is great. I've seen him in high A whenever he was here with Hickory. We talked about this on the previous podcast. I'm not going to dive into it. He is a very, very good player, you know, and honestly, in a normal year where he wasn't competing against Skeens and Cruz, he would have been a no doubt 1-1 for MLB. You know, he was 1-1 for the majority of us in Dynasty. And if you would have said that in July, like mm-hmm. I did whenever the draft happened, mm-hmm. You would have been laughed at.
Right.
Like, honestly, you would have been laughed at. What are you talking about? You're not going to pick Skeens or Cruz anyway. But I digress. I completely agree with what you're saying. I don't want to put any sort of Hall of Fame comps on him like that. I think that Scott is a much better hitter than what Estuary Ruiz was and is. And here's the thing. So the Cardinals are not typically a stolen base team. So let's remember this, okay? What he was doing in the minor leagues, yes, it is the same organization. It might be different in the majors. We saw last year as well, when Jordan Walker was not struggling with the bat, but struggling with where they wanted him to put the ball, they sent him down.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's a very, I'd say probably an 80% chance that Victor Scott's going to go back down to the minor leagues.
Right.
In, you know, a week, 2 weeks, a month, however long it takes for, you know, them to get right. And then they're going to bring him back up. So, you know, we can get excited about what he's doing, what he's not doing here. But the Cardinals are a very safe organization. They're going to be able to utilize him the way that they need him. And they prioritize defense. It's something that the outfield has been sorely lacking for quite some time. So he brings a good defensive aspect to it. Yes, he will steal bases. I don't personally believe that he's going to get to where Ruiz was last year. Not out of the fact that he can't do it, because we know he can do it. But more so, the Cardinals are not going to just let him run wild out the gates. We might see a season like that down the line once they know what they have, and for sure. But I agree with everything you said, Jake. I think that he is a better all-around player than what Ruiz is, and Ruiz was being exposed for that. So really all he had was the speed at that point last year.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's those are all good points. You know, it'll be glorious, and then he'll get sent down, and everyone's going to be really mad, and then he's going to come back, and then, you know, it'll all work itself out. He'll be back in the majors before long. But that kind of wraps up the segment on the players that made debuts or that made rosters after not having any previous major league experience. So we're going to take a quick ad break, and then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about the college players who have really taken steps forward in their development, their draft stock, their performance, and kind of talk a little bit about what that means for you to kind of already be thinking a little bit about the MLB draft and your first year player drafts for 10 months from now. Never too early. All right, we'll be back in a minute. All right, and we are back. So the college baseball season is in full swing. Conference play just started recently. They are really just, they've been going at it for a while. I know college gets a little bit of attention at the beginning of the season. We're desperate for some spring games that starts before MLB spring training. The hype around the major league season happens. You really get invested in the majors, of course, because it's the majors. And college kind of falls off until the College World Series. And that's when you kind of catch up on all of the different the changes in draft stock and things like that. And you start to get more familiar with the breakout guys. But we are trying to, thank you to Rick, bring you the names that you can, you know, be a bit more aware of and how their stock is changing, going up, going down as the season progresses, with a little bit more updates kind of throughout. We're going to probably do this once or twice. And just to give some updates on how guys are doing. So, Rick, did you have anything to add about you're the guy that's really been paying attention to college baseball. You've written about it a little bit more, and huge hats off to you, because it's really kind of like a lot of like the lower levels of the minors. So not a ton of information. I have a vendetta against the ESPN app for giving it a horrible, horrible treatment in there. There's nothing on these games. But I digress. Rick, what are your thoughts about the college baseball season so far?
Yeah, so I'm kind of a bachelor. I'm trying to get a lot deeper into college baseball than what I previously was. I dived into it a little bit last year. This year, really trying to do a little bit more. College baseball can be difficult sometimes to be able to follow, because obviously they're playing, you know, 3 or sometimes 4 games a week. So you kind of got to catch it wherever you can. And, you know, just like you said, I mean, the way I've looked at it this year is definitely treating it almost like another level of the minor leagues, because you're seeing what these guys can be able to do in certain divisions against, you know, better competition. and trying to rank them accordingly. And it's hard because with a lot of these, and we'll talk about some of these guys, I mean, they're putting up video game like numbers, like impossibly hard to be able to try to, you know, correlate what that would be whenever you get over into the minor leagues. You know, we talked a little bit about Wyatt Langford and what he was able to do at Florida in less games than Cruz and Skeens. Well, Cruz, you know, if you're comparing position players, and he was able to put up impressive numbers. We don't know how all this translates, you know, until they get over, right? Cruz struggled a little bit whenever he ended up coming over and going to Double A, whereas Langford just continued to skyrocket. So, you know, I feel like whenever we do this type of segment or this type of episode, it's important more so in my mind to be able to give you guys the most information as possible as soon as possible. And you can do with it what you will from there. We're going to be talking about a lot of prospects that are going to be going in the first round. We're going to be talking about some of the prospects that are might be falling out of the first round. And, you know, when the MLB draft comes up, you guys are going to be more aware of what the or who these prospects are heading into the draft and whenever they're drafted. So you get a good idea of what they might be able to help their new team with, in my opinion. So, you know, we'll dive into some of the names here of the, you know, players that are doing well as the ones that are struggling. I think that you'll find that this draft will have a lot of really good values. In my opinion, so far to this point in the college baseball season, there's still a lot to be played. So that could all change. But as of right now, I see a lot of good values. I see a lot of pitching that is looking sharp going into this draft. This is all not including high school talent. We'll talk about high schoolers later on, you know, as we get more information with that leading up to the draft. But Jake, I'm really kind of excited to be able to talk about some of these guys and, you know, prep everybody for what's coming down the pike.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because, you know, the draft is always such a, you know, a spectacle. It's now part of All-Star Weekend. It's always a ton of fun. And, you know, it's also kind of an afterthought for a lot of the first part of the year. And then all of a sudden the All-Star break happens and then it's part of the festivities and you get really into it. And last year was really the first year that I knew a good amount about most of the players in the first round and even a bit beyond, like really try to get more knowledge going into it. And I think it really helped even just kind of formulate my thoughts on FYPDs and some dynasty rankings and things like that, you know, a little bit earlier than usual. And I think was just a little bit less stressful coming in the off season, kind of preparing for the actual drafts and making trades. I think that's a huge part of this. If you can look at the talent that will be available in FYPDs and get a good gauge of the values of a top first round pick, of a mid first round pick, of a late first round pick. And then as the season kind of goes on, before the actual draft happens, you also get a good sense of who in your league is good and in your dynasty leagues, which teams are good and which teams are bad. What I, you know, tried to do more of last year was run projections. You know, there's I think it's Fantasy Pros, this is what I used, where you can import your league into the website and it spits out projections for the rest of the year for standings. And I'll take a team that's projected lower but currently in the standings higher and go and trade for their, you know, first or second round pick. And in like May, maybe June. And you can really get potentially a good value. And there's obviously risk involved because it's very far out and a lot can happen in the season. You don't want to do it all the time. But I think that there's a little bit of like edge that you can get in trade negotiations when some guys are like competing and they're like, yeah, I'll throw away my pick. What, like, it's a draft pick. It's in the future. It's almost a year from now. Who cares? But you know, like, okay, like I might be able to get, I don't know, Rick, who, like Hagen Smith, you know, in the early second and the late first, maybe, you know, I might be able to get a good value on somebody. And like, that is, I think, a big boost to, you know, roster building, especially if you are trying to rebuild your farm a little bit. And I think that's where this is particularly helpful for me, is just mapping out the value of draft picks when you're working on trades. As it gets more clear in your league, who are the contenders, who's going to be rebuilding, and how to kind of take advantage of these situations.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree anymore. Really, that's one of the main things with some of these deeper dynasty leagues is getting these draft picks years in advance. And a lot of the, you know, dynasty analysts, you know, such as, you know, Clegg Cross, myself, you know, Chris Welsh, we're looking at a lot of this stuff several years in advance. Jeff Ponce, with what he does over at Baseball America, amazing stuff. Okay. So if you can acquire those picks, you trust in the folks that you like to listen to or read, you know, we'll be able to guide you down a good path to be able to, you know, really get a leg up. And the more and more that I've done this over years, you can buy into these guys for a lot less, and it's getting in on the ground floor. That's as simple as I can say. You don't have to trade massive capital to be able to get this. Now, if you wait until draft day, yeah, you're going to, because there's names attached to those picks. So you're better off doing it well in advance. Save yourself the headache, save your team, you know, and just kind of go from there.
Yeah, no, I made a trade for a first round pick the day before the MLB draft last year. Worst thing I could have done. You know, I was happy with what I ended up getting, but it was, the hype had already happened. Like, everyone knew what the value of that pick was, and they knew exactly why I wanted it. And you have such a disadvantage in the negotiations, because they're like, yeah, you want this, you know, that you want a part of this top, you know, crop of talent. So as far as the actual guys that we can talk about here that y'all can kind of be aware of, Rick, where do you want to start? You pulled out some really fantastic names here, of guys that have been performing really well so far in the college season. So who really sticks out the most to you as far as increasing their draft stock?
So, I mean, let's talk about who, in my mind, is kind of the default 1-1, okay? And this is somebody who has really, really climbed up my rankings, you know, relatively well. He's in the top five. But, you know, with some of the top names, I mean, this guy immediately, you know, moved above them in short order. Then you take into effect what he was able to do afterwards. It all makes sense. I'm talking about Charlie Condon. He's a first base outfield player for Georgia. And whenever you're watching this guy, he is a draft eligible sophomore. So we'll start with that. So, you know, you only have the 2 years to be able to go off of at this point. But you watch game film of him. He's 6'6". He's 216 pounds. He is a big boy. And he destroys baseballs. Like, absolutely destroys it, no doubt about it. This year, he has 17 home runs currently, which is one of the best in NCAA right now. I believe it's second.
Yeah.
I believe it's second right now.
Yeah.
I think the other one is like from Winthrop. So it's like a, anyway. But if you see what he's doing right now, in 25 games played at Georgia, he's slashing .517, .637, 1.214 slug. I mean, absolutely insane numbers. I mean, this is MLB the Show, right? But he is absolutely killing it. 39 runs scored, 37 RBIs. He has 2 stolen bases, but do not expect, you know, stolen bases down the line here. This is a guy that is going to be a massive power hitter. You know, and in my mind, I think that there is a good chance that, you know, Cleveland, it depends, right? Because Cleveland could go pitcher. They could go, you know, Chase Burns, something along that line. Hagen Smith is really one that I would probably go with there if I was them. But, you know, Chase Burns is very good. Charlie Condon, to me, would be great. I think you could play him in the outfield. And that would be their justification for drafting him, because, you know, you stick him with DeLauder out there. Oh, my. That would be something. At first base, obviously, you have Manzardo. So I don't know if that's really what they want to do. But in my mind, he should be 1-1 based on what he's been able to do to this point. Really fun prospect to watch so far.
Yeah, what... what do you think it's really been to, that puts him clearly above, you know, guys like Travis Bezzana, who maybe offers a bit more of more athleticism up the middle defense, I think a little bit more speed, you know, or like the top, you know, pitcher Chase Burns, you know, what do you, or even Jack, you know, what mm-hmm. has really kind of launched him above those guys very clearly for you?
I mean, for me, I think that he's fundamentally a solid hitter. I think the power is far and away better. Bezzana had a he had a great start to the year against competition that he needed to hit well against, and you saw the massive power output happen during those games. You know, whenever you're looking at Condon, he is hitting against SEC talent, some of the best that's out there right now. So, like, and that's the thing, you know, why Langford came from the SEC. You know, a lot of these prospects that we do see that do very well transitioning batting-wise into the major leagues and minor leagues, for that matter, primarily come from the SEC or the ACC, you know? So I think Condon has a lot of upside here. When it comes to that, like I said, it really comes down to what Cleveland's going to want to do. If they want best available and they don't care about, you know, where he's going to play or whatever, Condon's the guy. You know, I could, like I said, I could see a scenario in which that they go pitcher. They have, you know, taken some pitchers here in the top rounds, you know, in the recent, you know, couple drafts. So to me, that's why he stands out. I think that, you know, a lot of these other guys, and we'll talk about some of them here in just a little bit, are very good in their own right. But to be 1-1, you know, preseason, I had Nick Kurtz 1-1. JJ Weatherholt was really like a 1-B. You know, these are high contact, high power with Kurtz, you know, high contact ability with Weatherholt. And Condon just blew by them easily. To me. So that's why I have him at the very, very top. And whenever I do my new update, he will be there.
Right. Love that. As far as the debate for Cleveland is where to go, hitter or pitcher, I think it's, why not both? Why not grab Jack Caglione? And I wanted to get your take. Do you think it's possible, like it's legit that he could stick with both? Because I mean, we've seen some really talented two-way players, you know, come into drafts recently, you know, but they haven't been able to stick with it. You know, it was the big one was Brandon McKay a couple of years back from Louisville, the Rays drafted. Reggie Crawford is now not pitching anymore, just focusing on hitting, where he'll still be incredible. Even Paul Skeens was a two-way player in college and even kind of stopped doing it at LSU. So, you know, we've seen the Shohei Ohtani obviously be the insane example, and we've seen guys usually kind of fizzle out at some point in the journey to the major leagues and end up focusing on one. Really, is there any chance that Caglione is the guy to buck that trend and to stick with it?
I mean, listen, there's always a chance. You know, whenever you look at what he has been able to do, for me, the bat is far and away his best carrying tool. I shouldn't say far and away, but let me back up. What concerns me with his pitching in general is not the strikeouts, because he is very, very effective when it comes to that. The problem that I have with Jack is that he struggles with the walks. That is one thing that he has, you know, struggled with quite a bit. In the 2 years that he has been pitching. Now, this year, he's getting a lot better results just in general. But whenever you look at the fact that he's pitched 27 and a third innings pitch, he's walked 18 batters to this point. That's pretty darn high. You know, I think it depends on the organization. If the Guardians wanted to take that risk, that would probably be a good fit, because you know that the outfield or first base will work for him. And you might be able to get, you know, a lot with the arm here. I don't know, man. To me, I focus more so on him being an outfielder and with the bat long term. And for him, you know, 24 games played, he's slashing 402, 479, 775 with 12 home runs. He's gone on a home run streak here as of recently. He's really been racking it up. 28 runs scored, 27 RBIs. You know, the bat is really, really good. Personally, going into this year, I thought that this was obviously a former teammate of Wyatt Langford, but this would be the guy that I would think who would have that Wyatt Langford jump, you know? And, you know, whenever it all comes down to it, it really might be the two top batters up at this class is Jack Aglione and, you know, Charlie Condon. Is a very real possibility. So I'll be interested to see where he ends up going in the draft. I think that he will probably be within the first, probably the first five picks, if I had to guess.
Yeah. Okay. I think, honestly, hearing that he, you know, struggles a bit with the walks, I mean, I would really buy in. I think if he just scrapped the pitching and we drafted him as a hitter, I think if that, at least, you know, I think part of the kind of, you know, reason why I wasn't in love with Reggie Crawford was that, like I don't want to guess at what I'm going to get out of it. I don't know. I want to know if I'm taking a pitcher or a hitter, and what I can kind of expect, because it's very different, you know, picking one versus the other in a draft like this and like an FYPD. And you, like, if you tell me that, like, okay, Caglione is going to be a hitter, like, he hits the ball really hard, like, this is his, you know, his plate skills, you know, and he's going to focus on that, that honestly maybe makes me feel a bit safer. You love to chase the upside and think about the possibilities and watch the game, like, watch the games now and savor it while he can really take advantage of this. Because, yeah, I think it's probably the case that he ends up focusing on just the hitting, and I think that would honestly make me like him even a bit more. Mm-hmm. And then next guy I wanted to ask about here, Hagen Smith, really, I think in my perspective and a lot of other casual college fans' perspectives, Hagen Smith broke out this year. And it started with that, of course, the debut, 17 strikeouts all over Twitter. He faced, I think, what, 18 batters, 19 batters, struck out 17 of them. I mean, it was ridiculous. But I went back and looked at his stats, and lo and behold, he was pretty darn good last year. 71.2 innings and 109 strikeouts with a 3.64 ERA. 3.64 ERA in college in the SEC is fantastic. Of course, it doesn't even hold a candle to the 1.24 he has this year. Not quite an SEC play yet as much, but I mean, I think that he was already a very good pitcher. And now we've seen some of it come up on Twitter. We've seen some of the hype train kind of happen, those huge strikeout games. So, Rick, from your perspective, like, how much has he really risen for you with these performances? And, like, you know, how legit do you think that this is? Maybe where do you think he might go in a draft? Do you have any insight on kind of the Hagen Smith story here?
Yeah, so with Hagen Smith, you know, he has really taken some major steps forward going into this year. And, you know, currently, I think if you ask almost anybody, I think they would have Chase Burns above Hagen Smith. And I don't know if I could do it.
Wow. You know, okay.
I don't know if I could do it. You know, I do like Chase Burns a lot. But whenever you're talking about Hagen Smith, who is, you know, leading NCAA right now in strikeouts per nine with 19.2. I mean, that is absolutely filth. That is filth. He has less innings pitched, you know, with more strikeouts than Chase Burns. 29 innings pitched, 62 strikeouts to this point. And that's only in six starts. That is ridiculous. You know, a 1.24 ERA, pitching in the SEC, he's lowered his walk rate down. So, like, he's making the adjustments that are necessary there with lowering the walks to a 3.1.
Like, cut previously in half. The walk rate's, like, cut in half, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, he's cutting that down. He is pitching against arguably the best talent that's in college baseball right now. You know, I personally like it. I think it's a great way to go. When it comes to Wake Forest has, you know, played against some pretty decent competition, more or less. But I know I just saw the series with Louisville this past weekend. But I don't know, man. I think Hagan Smith is facing better competition that's making them work a little bit harder for it.
Yeah.
You know, and I hate to say that because I want to be Chase Burns over him.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if I could do that after watching some of these Hagan Smith starts, man.
Yeah. I mean, Hagan Smith might even be a little safer. You know, I think he probably has less reliever risk. He's a better command. He's not quite as like the high velo, but like 95 from the left side is nothing to scoff at. Like that'll work. And like you said, with the competition, you know, his first four appearances were against James Madison, Oregon State, Murray State, and McNeese. Oregon State, obviously powerhouse program. And then he has pitched two games in the SEC against Missouri and Auburn. Those two games, his first two games in the SEC this year against Missouri, 6 innings, 2 hits, 1 walk, 10 Ks, no earned runs. Against Auburn, 6 innings, 3 hits, 2 walks, 12 Ks, no earned runs. So he did not miss a step. He has continued right in stride and has just been cutting through the SEC just as well as he did against all the non-conference opponents, which is, I think, huge when you start looking at how these guys have broken out this year. And, you know, has it been against those non-conference opponents, against the McNeese and the Murrays of the world, or now as you start facing the big guys, if you can keep it up? And that's a fantastic sign that he really hasn't slowed down much at all.
Mm-hmm.
All right, moving on. Let's see here. There's a couple more guys that we could chat about real quick. Brody Brett with Iowa, and I mean, his strikeout's been ridiculous, but it's just the walks. The walks have been tough for him. Like just a ton of walks. Can't find the strike zone. Iowa in general, they've been tough. They've been disappointing. But and then of course you have Tommy White, who, I mean, just from the minute that he has appeared in college baseball, has just been an offensive force. But you don't see him very high on draft rankings. He's not exactly the stereotypical MLB prospect. Kind of reminds me a bit maybe like Ivan Melendez, who just like, you know, hit all those homers and then wasn't drafted very high, is, you know, really kind of a power bust guy. And Tommy White is, I think, a better hit tool, but, you know, really isn't seen as like a top draft prospect. Where do you go valuing those two guys who are performing well, but definitely have their warts and, you know, maybe might not seen as like top end, top half of the draft talent?
Yeah. So when it comes to Tommy White, or as a lot of us like to call him, Tommy Tanks, from
Tommy
his
Tanks.
Time with NC yep. State. Yeah. Broke all of our hearts. But anyway. With when it comes to Tommy White, man, there's very real power there that I think that he still needs to kind of work to get to. The start of the year was a little dry for him, but he started hitting his stride. A little bit more home runs here recently. The average has started to come back up. I think overall, I think that he's going to be a solid contributor, you know, third base, first base prospect whenever he gets to the minor leagues. Currently with LSU, once again, another SEC team, you know, powerhouse in terms of baseball, 26 games played, a 321 average, 411 OBP, and a 557 slug, with, once again, 7 home runs, 22 runs scored, 23 RBIs. You're not going to get much speed with Tommy Tanks. But man, whenever he gets into it, it goes. And it is impressive moonshots whenever you see it from him. When it comes to Brody Brett with Iowa, I really like the stuff. I think, just like with what you said, when it comes to the command and control, limiting the walks are going to be an issue. You know, whenever I watch him, I know that he's, you know, primarily working fastball, slider. He does have a splitter as well. So kind of a small pitch mix to this point. But the way that he pitches just reminds me of, you know, early Glasnow. Just a bulldog going after guys, you know, going from that standpoint. Now, obviously, missing the major you know, curveballs that Glasnow is known for. But if he can, for me, if he falls in the draft, it would end up being probably towards the back end of the first. And if you're thinking in that range, then you're thinking Tampa Bay Rays, you're thinking about Dodgers, you're thinking about, you know, Houston. You're looking at these organizations.
The league can't let that happen, right?
Like, it really can, right?
Right, exactly. Right.
Because he only needs, like, his control to be tweaked, right? Yeah. Like, and even, here's the thing, the Mets, you guys, bear with me for a moment.
All right, Mets, Rick,
have put so much money into their pitching factory that, and here's the thing, they've been drafting a lot of these types of pitchers that either are relief pitchers or have a relief pitcher risk and being able to get the most out of them. He would be awesome to be able to draft at that point, develop a third pitch, harness the control. You know, I mean, if he's walking, you know, three per nine, I'll take that as long as he's striking out what he's doing right now. You know what I mean? So I foresee him falling in the first round. I think he still goes in the first, but I think he's going to fall to one of those, you know, teams that do a very good job developing pitching. And man, if he goes to the Dodgers, I'm done. I'm just going to pack it up. And
yeah, the Rays have 18, pick 18 this year. That sounds like a good spot. The Mariners have 15. That's another really great pitching development team. Mets are at 19. Twins are at 21. I think one of maybe the Brewers at 17. I think that's kind of the sweet spot for him. And really, there are teams, I think that's where his value kind of ends up. And I think that those teams can squeeze a lot out of a guy like him, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. And I think that's what's going to be so interesting about this. He's having a good year. He just needs some work in that regard, right?
Right.
So, like, we're really kind of nitpicking him a little bit. But the next section that we'll talk about, you know, there's going to be some really good values in the back end of the first round, potentially even in the early rounds of the second.
Yeah. Speaking of values in the early rounds of the second, let's talk about some guys who are falling. We're going to get to that right after the ad break. All right, we're back. And, you know, we talked about the guys who've been rising a whole lot and really impressed us and can see their draft stock really kind of taken off a little bit. And now let's talk about a few guys who have struggled out of the gate, maybe are slipping in draft rankings and could still be really good values, both for major league teams, kind of in that back half of the first, maybe even early second, and then also, of course, in your FYPD drafts. Rick, again, lead the charge here. Our resident expert on all things, you know, low minor leagues, college baseball, and whatnot. Who are you looking at here as someone who's really kind of been disappointing for whether it's, you know, due to injury or just like a slow start? You know, who's kind of that the first guy that comes to your mind here that has really had their value changed so far in this college baseball season?
Yeah, so far and away, the one that has really kind of disappointed me to this point has been Nick Kurtz with Wake Forest. He's a first baseman for them. Went into the year, I'd say almost, I'm not going to say unanimously, but across the board, Nick Kurtz was either one or two in most of these preseason, you know, rankings. Was my number one going into this year. And you know, this is a guy who stands 6'5", 240 pounds, bats from the left side. I mean, he is a big, powerful first baseman. And, you know, we've seen last year in 2023 when Wake Forest went to, you know, the College World Series and everything along that line, we saw that power. We saw a advanced hit tool that would be able to play. And honestly, even this year, watching him at first base, he is an excellent defender. I don't think I've seen a first base prospect that is as good as he is. He will sacrifice his body. He will make all the plays. I know this doesn't equate much for fantasy purposes, but bear with me because it will in terms of where he gets drafted. That's kind of the main kicker, right? But this year so far, he's played 18 games. I think he's battling a little bit of nagging injuries too, but the frustration I've already seen in person several times. 18 games played, a 236 average, 494 OBP, a 436 slug. We got 3 home runs, 19 runs scored, 10 RBIs, and a stolen base as well. Now, Wake Forest in general has really kind of missed the mark from where they were last year, obviously missing quite a few pieces. Still some impressive prospects that are on their team, including Siever King. But with Nick Kurtz, it just seems like he hasn't been able to get the ball rolling, and it's kind of carrying a little bit with the whole team. They started number one in the country. They've now fallen back to 15, I believe. So it might just kind of be running across the board here. But with Nick Kurtz, it's hard to see, man, because he's making contact whenever I watch him. You look at his strikeouts. He only has 12 strikeouts in 55 at-bats. So he's not striking out a ton. The contact that he's making, he's hitting the ball hard. It's just not landing for hits. You see it with the OBP. A 494 OBP is fantastic. 28 walks in those 55 at-bats. So he's walking. He's getting on base. And the power just has not shown up. I don't know if there's a nagging injury that's sapping his power to this point. But I think, from going from a number one prospect this year, he's probably going to fall a good 20 spots or so and continue to fall unless he picks it up. We still have plenty of big college baseball to play, and he could turn it around. But to me, I think that this could be a massive value for not only an MLB team where he gets drafted, but also for us in Dynasty with first-year player drafts in, 10, 11 months, whenever. So to me, this is a guy that I want to watch the rest of the season. I want to see how he finishes, how strong it is, and I want to see what he does once he's drafted. And this is another thing that Jake brought up earlier about acquiring draft picks. Even if you are in a deeper dynasty league and you want to try to acquire some of these types of draft picks, this is a guy that's borderline 70 grade power. A 60 to 65 grade hit tool out of an 80 scale. This is a top-tier prospect that is just hitting a real rough spot. And if he can't get those numbers up sky high where you want to see them, I at least want to see how he finishes the year going into the draft and then going into the minor leagues. If he ends the year on a high note, I'm all in because I think that the talent is there. And defensively, these teams want defense because it saves runs. So that's what I think with Nick Kurtz. He's my number one that we need to talk about on this.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, it's kind of crazy because college ball is already a small sample. Even with the amount of games, they do play a ton of games. You end up getting a decent sample size. But it's, all things considered, it is a very small sample that, teams, as far as statistical output, are making decisions on, and that we are making decisions on in FYPDs and whatnot. And in a pretty short season, if you spend any decent chunk of it struggling just to find outfield grass as much as he has, it can take a huge toll on the final stat line, on like the mentality. And it's really hard to, I think, for me to believe in the fact that like he's all of a sudden a different hitter, especially because we haven't really heard anything about like any drastic changes, whether it be an injury or just a change in skills, contact rate, whatever it is. Maybe he falls a little bit. It's really hard to tell. I was trying to think if there was any kind of example of maybe a college hitter who was supposed to be great and kind of fell a little bit. Last year there really isn't one. Haven't gone back too much further, but it's still with college hitters, it's always tough because the high school guys will obviously come in and make a lot of noise. You'll get a handful of them in the first, half of the first round, probably. Like last year, you had like Tommy Troy, Matt Shaw, and Kyle Teal go 12, 13, 14, middle of the first round with incredible offensive seasons coming off just such great performances. They didn't quite have the you know, the pedigree that Kurtz has going in. But like, even in college, a great hitting season will only get you so far because, you know, in theory, there might be less upside, a little bit more advanced. Some of these high school guys, the projectability is off the charts. And so it's an interesting balance. And, you know, it's struggling in college, even for an incredible hitter. It'll be really interesting to see how far he falls and kind of where he kind of ends up there. Because like you said, those raw skills are still there. Like, he's still a really great hitter. Those defensive skills haven't gone anywhere. That's a really good thing to kind of anchor to a, you know, to a team, to a starting lineup. So really interesting stuff there, and potentially a value, you know. Even if what's interesting is that I think with FYPDs, it's funny because we get introduced to the player pool in July and then we actually act on it. We actually do the drafts in December, January, February. And so there's so much time. Like we saw with Wyatt Langford, you know, if you were kind of in on him at the beginning, it really sucked to watch him be so good and then just take over that unanimous 1-1, because it was like, man, like, thought I could have gotten him 1-2-3, you know, like, or 2-3-4 maybe. Even after he went fourth overall, and it was like, wow, that's such a drop. He fell so much. He still ended up the 1-1 because he just killed it. So much, you know, can change, and maybe Kurtz doesn't even end up being a value. Maybe he finishes the year decently well. He gets drafted. He does well in high A, whatever. But maybe hoping that can stay the case, that he might be a good value. You can maybe get him in the back end of a first of an FYPD, because, those skills are still pretty good. And sticking with Wake Forest on the pitching side, Josh Hartle, he was their Friday guy, you know, really in a good spot to kind of follow in the footsteps of Rhett Lauder. And he has really struggled. I was shocked to see the kind of drop in strikeouts, even beyond the results. So Rick, what have you seen from Josh Hartle so far and his draft stock going into the summer?
Yeah. So he was one of the top names in college baseball in terms of, you know, pitchers going into this year, and rightfully so. What he did last year in 2023 was fantastic. You know, 17 starts, 18 total games played. So he came out of the bullpen once, 102 and a third innings pitched, 140 strikeouts. He was one of the top pitchers in NCAA in terms of strikeouts. And this is a guy that, you know, doesn't work with high velocity at all. Last year, none of his pitches ever topped 90. So he was primarily working, you know, slower velocities, working with his movement and his control. His command and control is what really did it for him. You know, a 2.1 walks per nine. He had a 12.3 K per nine in 2023. Now, going into this year, obviously, the Friday night starter, a spot of honor in college baseball. If you're a Friday night starter, you are the guy that's leading that rotation. It's just been really tough sledding. He ended up, I've seen out of his six starts, I've seen four of them, and I've seen an increase in velocity. He's sitting around 92 now, so he's increased it by quite a bit, but the problem is his pitches are not moving the way that they used to. So the increase in velocity has hurt his movement. This is equated in hits per game, and he gets hit a ton. I don't see a lot of swing and miss at all whenever I'm watching him in game. To put this into perspective, in his six games that he's played, 29 innings pitched, 26 strikeouts, and he's given up 39 hits. To equate that, that's a 12.1 hits per nine. 12.1. He's getting hit a lot. The walks per nine are slightly up, but they're right on par with where they were, 2.8. I'm not worried about that from that standpoint, but the strikeout per nine has dropped from a 12.3 in 2023 to an 8.1 this year. You know, he's sitting here with a 7.14 ERA at this point. I'm a little concerned at what's going on. You know, if he's pitching through an injury, if this increased velocity is causing him not to have movement, that is concerning to me. You know, Wake Forest has done a very good job with their pitching development. And usually you'll end up seeing them get the most out of these pitchers. And a lot of times, like what we've seen in the last couple drafts, you know, the Braves have taken Ryan Cusick, you know, which was a Wake Forest pitcher, went in the first round and struggled mightily, you know, wasn't able to improve from there. I'm worried that Josh Hartle is kind of having that issue. To have those strikeouts drop so drastically, he is not a flamethrower. He is a command pitcher. I don't know how far he will fall. In my opinion, I would almost bet on him falling into the second or third round with how far this has gone to this point.
Right.
And it's sad. It's sad because the numbers were fantastic. It was trending in the right direction. So, yeah, Josh Hartle, a little hard to watch right now.
Right. Yeah, I'm looking at draft results from last year, and Brandon Sproat went second round, 56th overall. Drew Hackenberg, Virginia Tech, went second round, 59th overall. I think it's probably a good spot, you know, but that you kind of maybe might fall to. You know, these college pitchers, you know, some of them get really pushed up and the ones with kind of these elite skills, but it's very easy to kind of fall as a college pitcher. And I think that that's a decent comp with those two guys. I'm probably expecting like late second round, about between 50 and 60 overall. And, you know, it could be a buying opportunity, but he is one that I would definitely want to see pitch ideally before, like in an organization, or hear more from an organization after the draft before really kind of buying in, you know, especially in an FYPD and in really any kind of shallow league. So interesting to kind of keep an eye on, because he still was that guy at one point, and it could see kind of that command kind of went out. But yeah, like you said, tough to watch that change there. A couple more guys that we want to touch on before we go. Next one, like you kind of mentioned earlier in the pod, J.J. Weatherholt, who was, like you said, 1B, middle infielder from West Virginia, you know, was... And for this one, the injury has kind of hampered him a little bit, kept him out, that he only kind of came back recently. So has this kind of changed your evaluation of him at all? He's only played 4 games, it looks like, so far. So what have you kind of gained from his situation this year?
Yeah, with Weatherholt, it's kind of tricky. I've seen some, you know, news on Twitter and stuff like that, you know, he just needs to stay healthy and then he could still be considered in the 1-1 spot. I think that might be a little bit of a stretch, personally. I don't see Cleveland kind of going this route. Even though he is a very Cleveland-esque type of player, profile-wise. Really, you got to kind of go back to what he did last year with West Virginia in 2023 to be able to get the idea as to why he was considered a 1A or 1B, in your opinion, going into this year. In 55 games played with West Virginia, he slashed .449, .517, .787, 16 home runs. He had 36 stolen bases with 67 runs scored and 60 RBIs. A solid contributor in that right. You know, a little bit of power, a little bit of speed, but really you're buying him for the bat. With this year already, I mean, even in the 4 games, you're seeing that he is hitting for average with .308, .438 OBP. But I don't know. I'm curious to see where he ends up falling. I think there's still a good chance that if he finishes the year strong, he could still make the first round. And in my opinion, that is still a very good value. I just worry that a team like the Oakland Athletics would go and take him, you know, and just continue to stockpile players that I just don't see contributing towards their team. You know what I mean? It just seems like a very Oakland A's pick.
Yeah, I can see it. Yep.
I don't mean to be mean, and I'm not trying to be mean to Weatherholt, but it just seems like a pick that you just go, huh. Jacob Wilson was that way this past year, where I was just like, huh. That's what you went with. All right, that works. So, like I said, the injuries really derailed his, you know, his season to this point. But he's still probably going to go in the first round. a solid infielder in general. So I like Weatherholt. I think he's going to be pretty solid long term.
Yeah. All right. Absolutely. And then moving on to the last guy that we got down here to chat about, Thatcher Hurd, starting pitcher from LSU. Again, in that SEC, really great conference play there. A tough start to the season for Hurd. Six games played, 26.2 innings pitched, 34 strikeouts, and a 7.09 ERA. He still has decent strikeouts, you know. That's good for an 11.5 K9, you know. But LSU, like, again, in the SEC, how much of it is the competition? How good is the raw stuff, you know? Like, at LSU last year, there were some decent values, you know, after the Skeens hype, you know, and it's a team that kind of continues to produce really great major league ready talent. So what's been your thoughts on Thatcher Hurd? He was in the bullpen last year, right? That he came into the starting rotation this year. Yeah.
Yeah. He made some starts last year, but primarily was a bullpen arm, for LSU. This is his first full year in the rotation, originally a transfer out of UCLA originally. But yeah, this year has just been, you know, kind of disappointing. We saw a lot of electric stuff out of him in 2023, where he made 23 appearances, 11 starts. He had a 5.68 ERA, but 63 and a third innings pitch, he had 84 strikeouts. So good strikeout per nine. This year, he's brought down the walks per nine to a 4.1, down from a 5.7. So still not great, but going in the right direction. As you said, the strikeouts are still there with 11.5. You know, with him, I think it's difficult to be able to kind of pinpoint exactly what's happening here. The walks per nine, obviously, are somewhat to be looked at here. But, you know, he reminds me a lot of what Ty Floyd kind of went through last year, where you look at what he did with LSU and the numbers overall were not, you know, jumping off the page. Obviously, whenever you have a teammate like Skeens, you know, it's hard to get some attention. Now, you strike out 13 in a you know, playoff game, then, yeah, you'll get attention. To me, Thatcher Hurd could be another Ty Floyd type of situation where he will be drafted, you know, potentially in the second, third round and be able to be a great value for an organization that could be able to, you know, work on his control, because really that's kind of what I think it's coming down to, and especially against really tough SEC talent. This is a guy that has an electric fastball, works with a curveball. The slider is fantastic as well. Good movement with the slider, and he has a changeup, but he doesn't work with it. This is something that we see a lot in college, especially in high schoolers in general. High schoolers typically don't work on their changeups. They go to college, and either you have an organization that stresses it and works on it, and then you have some that don't. And it's pretty apparent to this point that the Hurd isn't really working much with it. But primary sits mid-90s, touches out at 98 with his four-seam fastball. I like this profile. I think it could be a sneaky value, but really rough numbers here this year. And as a result, we'll probably end up falling as a result of it.
Yeah, no, I think that's definitely fair. But, you know, some of these college pitchers that go in the second round is definitely worth a second look, you know, because like I said earlier, the college season is tough. You know, it's short, it's brutal, and it's a pretty narrow snapshot, you know. So definitely kind of keep up to date with what's happening there with Thatcher Hurd. Maybe he goes and puts in some ridiculous performance in the College World Series, and then we'll all be on top of him again. But that will do the college coverage. Rick, huge shout out to you for really getting deep into the coverage of these players and, you know, giving our listeners a lot of insight well before the draft, so that you can kind of get a good sense of what the first and second round would look like, just, you know, for the college hitters, for the more known commodities. And it's been a cool conversation, you know, to hear you kind of talk about these guys and get some extra insight there. Everybody, give Rick his flowers. Follow him on X at Must Be the Hawk. You can follow me as well at Jake Mace. You can find the podcast, of course, at PL on the Farm. Our next episode is going to come out next week on Friday the 5th, and we'll be back at it. You know, we'll continue updating y'all on things that are happening as the season gets going and some prospects start to break out, get promotions and whatnot. We'll be on top of it. Also stay up to date on what's happening in college. And yeah, we'll be doing our thing. Have yourselves a great baseball week, everybody. Thank you for listening.